Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today spends her days surrounded by words, but she's not the one putting pen to paper. She's the proprietor of Shakespeare & Company Bookshop in Paris, on the left bank of the Seine. It's a legendary landmark of the city, a favourite haunt of iconic writers past and present. It came into existence in 1919 by another Sylvia, and it stood in its current form since 1951. Last year, however, the pandemic presented unforeseen challenges and the need to find new ways to connect with the Parisian community. Well, a wonderful book has now come out of this. It's called Shakespeare & Company Paris, A History of the Rag and Bone Shop of the Heart. Here's a conversation that I recorded with Sylvia in front of a live audience at the Cheltenham Literary Festival. So, Sylvia, you're named after the original proprietor of the shop, Sylvia Beach. Tell us about her.
Yes, this story starts with Sylvia Beach, who was a formidable American bookseller. She was from New Jersey. She was the daughter of a Presbyterian minister, and her family were real Francophiles. So they visited, as a family, they visited France several times. And so it was quite natural that Sylvia found herself in Paris looking to study French literature. On one of these visits, she met Adrien Monnier, which was a meeting that was to change her life. And Adrien Monnier, in fact, you know, I realize that our story, I always think it starts with Sylvia Beach, but in fact, it starts with Adrien Monnier, who was the first woman in France to open a lending library. She is considered the patron saint of booksellers in France. And she met Sylvia Beach, who came into her bookshop one day. Her bookshop was called La Maison des Amis des Livres. And Adrien encouraged Sylvia to open a bookshop in France with Anglophone books. Sylvia at one point was thinking about having a bookshop in New York with French books that could be a sort of sister bookshop of Adrien Monnier's. But through Adrien's support and friendship, she managed to open a place in the 6th arrondissement in Paris. And she had kind of incredible timing because it was just after the First World War. There were some of the greatest literary figures passing through Paris. Modernism was, this became a sort of center of modernism. And, you know, the cafes in Paris were a great place for people to meet and discuss and debate. But every movement needs a home. And Shakespeare & Company, Sylvia Beach's Shakespeare & Company, was a sort of home away from home. And many of the writers actually used it as a postal address even.
James Joyce was one of those.
Well, I mean, most of the writers of the Lost Generation went through Hemingway, Gertrude Stein, Juno Barnes, but of course, James Joyce. And there was a very particular relationship and friendship with Joyce because Sylvia Beach offered to publish Ulysses at a time when it was banned and no one else was able to publish it. It was fortunate that she printed Ulysses here in France, in Dijon, where the printers and the proofreaders couldn't understand what they were printing. So that might be one of the reasons it managed to come out in publication. But it was a real mammoth task that Sylvia took on. And Joyce had very few options because there are a few literary reviews in the UK through Harriet Weaver, and in the US with Margaret Anderson and the Little Review, published excerpts of Ulysses, but had got into a great deal of trouble for those publications. And so Sylvia made this offer, and I don't know if she knew what she was getting into, because he actually wrote a third of Ulysses on the proofs, which for anyone who in the publishing world knows that's extraordinary. But she did it, and she managed to have the first two copies available for his 40th birthday on the 2nd of February, 1922.
Amazing story. And you see so many things like that in the book. There's so much archival material and pictures published for the first time. Then the war came, the Second World War, and that wasn't easy for Sylvia.
No, I mean, her story is incredible. And even the end of her story, the closure of her bookshop, is quite a cinematic scene where she had her copy of Finnegan's Wake in the window, and a Nazi officer wanted to buy it and she refused to sell it to him. And so he told her that he would come back the next day, and if she didn't sell it to him, then he would confiscate all her belongings and close the bookshop down. So she decided to close it down herself overnight. Friends came and joined her and moved all the books upstairs where she had an apartment. And they painted over the sign. And so when the officer returned the next day, the bookshop had disappeared. And she never reopened, but she stayed in Paris and was a very important literary figure in the Paris literary scene until her death in 1962.
And how did your father, George Whitman, first come across her?
Well, so George found himself in Paris on the GI Bill. It was a good place to be. It was a cheap place to be. And the GI Bill was very generous. And so he and a lot of other Americans found that this was a good place to settle. And he always, you know, he loved the idea. He said, I'll read a quote here. "I long to bury myself in a really exciting city, a city where culture is vibrant, a city where music is passionately loved, and where love is something holy and beautiful, a city like Paris or Moscow, where poetry is part of life, where men are poets and life is a poem." And so he had been a bookseller in America. Then he was drafted into the Second World War. And so, like a lot of people, found themselves in new countries. And he was in Paris and he, you know, he was obsessed with books. And he was living in a hotel room on the Boulevard Saint-Michel. And he filled this room with books. And the GIs actually had a credit for buying books. And so he used this to sort of buy and exchange from other Americans in Paris. And he became friends with Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who was an extraordinary poet, one of the most celebrated American poets, activist and publisher and founder of City Lights Bookshop in San Francisco. And they became friends. And Lawrence said, you know, "You really should just open a bookshop here because you basically have a bookshop in your hotel." And so George found this extraordinary space in the shadow of Notre Dame. It was an Algerian grocery shop, and the Algerian family who ran it at the time wanted to leave Paris. And they met by accident in front of Notre Dame. And George said that he was actually looking for a place. And after the Second World War, this whole quartier was really kind of, George described it as a slum with sewage in the streets. And so it was not at all what it looks like today. And so little by little, George sort of expanded the bookshop. It was, you know, a bookshop. It was also his bedroom at first. It was a hotel for visiting writers. It was a sort of kitchen where you could come and have soup. So that's how he found himself.
And he carries that through. The motto of the shop, it hits you when you first walk in, is that quote, "Be not inhospitable to strangers, lest they be angels in disguise." And on his travels, he reciprocates by allowing a huge amount of people to sleep in the shop. So tell us about the tumbleweeds.
Yeah, that was really important to him, that he could give back what he had experienced. And he experienced a huge amount of generosity on his hobo adventures. You know, he went off he had hardly any money, and he hitchhiked, he walked, and he even traveled on the rooftops of trains or even underneath trains. And he did that going all the way through America and South America. And everywhere he went, he really came across very generous people who would either give him a place to sleep or a meal to eat. And so for him, it just made sense to give that back. And he called his guests tumbleweeds. And tumbleweeds, if you've ever seen a Western film, there are those rootless plants that they're very dry and they just sort of roll across the horizon. And so George would say that the tumbleweeds were wanderers, literary wanderers drifting in and out on the winds of chance. And it's been estimated that he housed around 30,000 tumbleweeds. And we have there's something kind of fairy tale like about it. Every tumbleweed is asked to work for a couple of hours a day in the shop, to read a book a day, and to write a one-page story of their life. And so we have thousands upon thousands of these stories that people have left behind. And they're kind of a specific format with a photograph and the person's address and then whatever interpretation someone wants to give of their life. And they're really, you know, beautiful. What's amazing and what's really striking about them, especially putting this book together, is that we saw that with the photographs, you know, of course, there's a change in style, in haircuts, but the sense of what people were looking for in this very particular age, the tumbleweeds tend to be people who have just left for formal education and are kind of going out into the world and deciding what they want to do and taking this moment to travel. And so there's sort of a really common thread of these people who are coming through in their early 20s and the sort of idealism and are looking for romance, looking for answers, and what better place to look for answers than in books and to be in a space where you're surrounded by books and with like-minded people. And actually, one of the really moving things putting this book together was reaching out to people who had tumbleweeded and saying, you know, are you the so-and-so who lived in the bookshop in 1978? And we'd get a response back saying yes or no. And if they said yes, we would send a scan of their biography. And people either had forgotten that they had written it or were just really happy to reread it. And, you know, there was a sort of common experience of people saying that the lasting legacy of their experience as a tumbleweed was the friendships that they made and friendships they made through books, and that it was a really sort of transformative experience, and that somehow it was like borrowed time, and also that it was possibly the first time that they were seriously considered a writer and that that was possible. And I think there's also just that element of surprise to find a bookshop, a commercial space in the center of a city that you can just go to the front desk and ask if there's a bed that night.
There are so many wonderful stories here about people turning up for the first time and George just throwing them the keys to the shop and saying he'll be back in a few hours. And then sometimes he's not back for a week.
There are so many stories like that. I mean, he was such an eccentric. I never met anyone so eccentric. And I think so many people have a sort of George story. Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who I mentioned before, the founder of City Lights, he was, you know, surrounded by the beatniks, surrounded by this San Francisco poet scene. And even he said that George was the most eccentric person he had ever met. And so that was sort of confirmed it for me. George would, you know, on a summer day, he would go out in his red silk boxer shorts and take the week's takings in a plastic bag to the bank and then hand it in at the bank. And then at the same time, lecture everyone working in the bank how they must come to the bookshop during their lunch break to read poetry because it's just an essential part of life, that a non-literary, non-informed life was unacceptable. They didn't come for their lunch breaks, but I think they had a giggle at that encounter. And so he sort of just created so many stories around him. And the reason we're talking so much about him is that he and the bookshop were just utterly intertwined. You can't really separate the two. And he would often say, you know, I created the bookstore like a man would write a novel, building each room like a chapter. And I like people to open the door the way they would open a book that leads into a magic world in their imagination. So there was already a story in him. And people, yeah, either got thrown the keys or got given a sort of dubious bowl of Irish stew to eat, or, you know, given a book that changed their life by him. Yeah, that's so many encounters.
Now, when I came to Paris a couple of weeks ago to see you, you were kind enough to shut the shop and take me on a tour around it. And it was so amazing. And you got the sense of how the shop has just grown organically. And I wondered if you'd walk us through it in words.
I mean, it's a real labyrinth. You quite literally can get lost in books in the bookshop. And first it starts with the sort of the fiction room, which is the main room, with the wishing well in the center, which is a well that people put money in. And when we have tumbleweed stain, they use this money for breakfast or for a bottle of wine at night. And it's also a well with quite a few stories because my dad loved to use this gas pipe that goes into the well and surprise people by putting a match in there, and then sort of a huge flame would light up, which is obviously a terrible idea to do in the middle of a bookshop, but it was very theatrical, and so he liked to do that. And I, in fact, I once, you know, it's extraordinary that the stories and the encounters you have with people around the world through the bookshop. And I once met a woman in New York who said that my father had accidentally burnt all her hair off by doing this wishing well trick. So I felt myself apologizing years later, very awkwardly, to this woman. So that is the wishing well in the center. And the building itself is extraordinary. It's 17th century. It was an old monastery. And it's sort of built in this kind of real ramshackle way. There's nooks and crannies. The floor is covered in marble. I really get that sense that people come to us because they really also want to experience the space, you know, opposite Notre Dame, right next to the Seine, which is covered in the Bouquiniste, the biggest outdoor bookshop. And right next to us is a park with the oldest tree in Paris. There's a really quite a strong sort of energy in the area. And then when you go in, it's very homemade. I mean, George really did build every corner like a chapter of his unwritten novel. And when I arrived, there was so much to do because the building was so old. There's just, you know, a lot of upkeep of the building to deal with. And George sort of was always into recycling and just, you know, making things, but he never could afford to really deal with things properly. So like the electricity was sort of stuck together with sellotape and occasionally sparks would fly. So there was a huge amount to do when I arrived just to sort of clean things up and make things safe. And then, you know, we added on recently a children's room and we added on an art room and a poetry room. And then if you go to the back of the bookshop, there are some stairs going upstairs to the reading room. It's a non-commercial space. And that's really important for us to keep that space, a space that's welcoming for people. If someone can't afford to buy a book, they can always go to the first floor and they have access to the very eclectic, random selection of books we have up there. Lots of biographies, lots of political books, history of Paris, history of France. And there's a piano, there's a cat, there's a mirror of love where people leave messages. That space was always really important to George and he really translated that to me. And we're trying to keep that available for everyone.
I want to talk a little bit about the 1960s, because obviously that was an incredibly febrile time in Paris, but it also led to a lot of difficulties for George with the authorities.
One of the things about this book is that we have a sort of, it's quite an unusual structure, but it felt really important to have this structure, which is there's a sort of main narrative going through the book, which is kind of the bookshop's voice. We sort of talk about this book as the bookshop's memoir. And that narrative has been fact-checked. The dates and names have been checked multiple times. And through that narrative, we really tried to take each decade, starting with the 50s and then through to today, and looking every decade at what was going on in the city. We really wanted the book to be looking outward and not just inward at ourselves. And so the 60s, for example, obviously the big theme was 1968 and sort of political uprising in Paris. And so we would then link that with what was going on in the bookshop. And so a way to connect that to the bookshop was throughout the book, we'd have first person stories. And those stories were really kept in their own voice. It gives you an impression from each person of what their experience was at the bookshop. And that felt really important because time and time again, I realize that this bookshop is made through layers of people's sort of participation here and experience here. And it belongs to so many people, not just one person or one family. It is really a multitude of personalities. And so through these first person stories, you have a kind of, you know, real direct view of what was going on and what people were experiencing. And then we have sort of photographs and memoirs and things. And so in the 60s, for example, maybe, I don't know, Georgina, I can just read, there's a little excerpt from a writer called Christopher Cook Gilmore. So Christopher Cook Gilmore was in the streets of Paris during 1968. And he says, "It was 9 o'clock at night and I was running for my life down Rue de la Huchette. There was a cloud of tear gas behind me, and in the middle of that cloud were about a dozen CRS goons, the biggest policemen you've ever seen, with huge batons and helmets. They'd just stormed the barricades, and we'd built a place at Saint-Michel. every shop was closed and every door was locked. And I was hoping that I could get to the Seine and jump in. But when I reached Saint-Jacques, there was a whole bus full of CRS guys. So I cut across the street and now I'm in Rue de la Boucherie. I see a light, one light, and I run down and I see this light inside a crazy old bookstore. There's an old man with a goatee there. I run in the door. I'm wearing an American fumet. I have a scarf across my face, an old trench coat around me. I look at the old man and I say, CRS. And he says, get upstairs. He flicks up off the lights, shuts the door, and we both run up the stairs. We see the police go by screaming, pounding on the cobblestones. And then I look up, and there across the Seine is Notre Dame. On top of the tower, these students are up there, and they've hung the biggest red flag you've ever seen, blowing out over the Place de Notre Dame, kilometer zero. And the old man looks at me, grabs my arm, and says, isn't this the greatest moment of your entire life?
If we jump to the 1980s, because that's when you were born, in 1981, and of course you were brought up in the shop, largely, it would seem, by tumbleweeds.
Yeah, I lived in the bookshop until I was about six, and then moved with my family to England, and then came back sort of sporadically. But those initial years at the bookshop were really bohemian and quite hectic, but really, I have very fond memories of them, and sort of walking barefoot around the bookstore and meeting people from around the world, having people sleeping all over the bookshop. At that time, you know, more and more people were traveling, and my dad just found it really difficult to say no to people. So sometimes there'd be 25 people sleeping in the bookshop, and you'd have to sort of walk across bodies to open in the morning. And George, he really loved Shirley Temple. So he would often ask me to try and do a Shirley Temple dance on the front desk at opening to encourage customers to come in. And so I did my best. And he also had a huge Alsatian dog called Baskerville. And if on a quiet day, because, you know, it wasn't like today. Today we have Paris is visited from people around the world, but there were times when it was really quiet. And so if he wanted more customers to come in, he would put me and the dog in the window. So, you know, I met lots of the tumbleweeds were just so exciting. I had so many crushes on them, and, you know, I found them fascinating, and they would obviously, you know, tell me all sorts of stories, whether it was reading books to me or telling me about their travel adventures. And one of the writers who really marked me the most was a writer called Ted Jones, who's not very well known now, but he's connected to the Beat Generation. And he was such a kind of a fun character. And this is before, you know, mobile phones and Facebook. So when he was in Paris, everyone knew if they wanted to see Ted, they could come to the bookshop at noon and he would be sitting there in front of the bookshop reading the International Herald Tribune. And anyway, he would tell me this poem where he'd say, if you ever see a man walking down the street talking aloud to himself, do not run away from him, but run towards him, for he is a poet and you have nothing to fear from the poet but the truth.
The 90s, finally, what was always going to happen happened, which was the bookshop burnt down.
Yes, that electricity spark, I think, really, it went off. We don't know the origins of the fire, but there was a fire that started on the first floor in the reading room. And George was sort of, he insisted on running. I wasn't there, but the witnesses say that he ran into the fire to throw out some of his absolute favourite books. He had the chance to acquire Simone de Beauvoir's library, and he had a lot of her books in there. So he managed to throw a lot of those books out of the window to be saved. And yeah, I mean, I think it was a terrible moment in the history of the bookshop. But what I laugh at and love the most is that the following day, when everyone was sort of, who was working at the bookshop or staying at the bookshop at that time, was sort of really depressed by this event, George just said, you know, don't mourn, organize. We've got to get on with it. So he grabbed all the books that had been damaged by the water from the firemen, put them outside, dried them, and just kept going.
And he did organize hugely, and so did his friends, because there was this big fundraiser.
There was a huge fundraiser, yeah, with friends and writers in New York, London and Paris who got together and who did readings and did fundraisings and that hugely helped the bookshop. And I think it was a sort of big morale boost at the same time to feel like people cared.
And he was worried about his legacy. You were living in England. You weren't very close at the time. He didn't know what was going to happen to the shop. And then you came back just for a brief visit. Well, tell us how that worked, from being a visit to this now being your life.
Yeah, I mean, he was, you know, as I said, he was very eccentric. And like many of us, he contained multitudes. And so he was sort of charming, but also difficult and cantankerous and mysterious and shy. And so he was, you know, I do think of him as a sort of King Lear or someone living in a fairy tale. And his kingdom was the bookshop. And in a way, if you weren't in the bookshop, you just weren't real to him. And so I was quite estranged from him growing up. I was growing up in the UK and in Scotland, and we sort of lost contact. And then after my studies, I was really aware that he was 88 at that time. He had me at a very late age in life. And I was aware that this was maybe, you know, a last opportunity to get to know him and that I needed to make that step. So I went towards him. I stepped towards him. It was really awkward to start with. He introduced me to everyone as Emily, an actress from London. And I didn't know why he was doing that. But then I realized that he realized it was quite a sort of public reunion and that everyone at the bookshop maybe would be asking lots of questions if they knew who I was. Everyone who did actually know who I was because they had seen photos of me as a child and recognized me. So it was a kind of weird role play that I decided to play along with and pretend to be Emily. And anyway, so we had this sort of first encounter that was quite strange. But then I very, very quickly fell in love with him, with books, with Paris, and with the bookshop. And I feel like I really understand the experience that Tumbleweeds have because I came back when I was 19 and then sort of came back every summer until I was 21 when I decided to stay. So I really had this sort of experience of discovering the city through the bookshop and discovering books. And it was a really, really pivotal and powerful moment in my life and changed my life. And here I am, still there.
You've been knocked by the pandemic. When I came to see you recently, we spoke about what could be done. And thinking back to that fundraiser that was done after the fire in the 90s and discussing if perhaps it's time to do that again.
You know, like so many places, I'm aware that it's not unique to us, but we have really struggled. And for 15 months, we lost money. And there was in France, what was difficult was that in the administration, we weren't considered affected by tourism. And of course, we have sort of built up a structure to deal with tourism because we are in a hot spot of tourism. And so to not be considered affected by tourism put us in quite a problematic financial situation. And so we lost all of our savings during the pandemic, and we're still here. We're still going, and we're resilient, and we will carry on. And we're definitely seeing the light at the end of the tunnel and definitely seeing visitors come back, which is just amazing. There's always a silver lining to these kind of crises. What we found really interesting and positive about the pandemic was that we were really put back in touch with our local clientele, with our French customers. And so we now have more books in French available, and we have the effect of more French customers was that Hemingway was knocked off our bestseller list and Virginia Woolf was put up there. So that was a really interesting period as well. But yeah, no, it was difficult. And so we, having lost our savings, we sort of find ourselves in a situation where we need to do a few things to kind of get back on our feet. And so we're finally considering maybe a fundraising, which is something that it's always difficult to ask for help, especially we've always been in a position to help others and, you know, to provide a place to sleep and to provide a place for people to read. And so it's quite difficult being on the other side. But this experience also showed me how many people care about the bookshop and have their sort of experience here that really has got nothing to do with anyone's sort of personality or ego. It's just to do with readers and their connection with here. So that sort of also gave me a boost to just get on with it.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Nora Hull and Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Also to the team at The Times and The Sunday Times Cheltenham Literature Festival. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thanks for listening.